The rain in Birmingham did not fall, it hung. It was a suspended gray curtain that blurred the edges of the city into a watercolor of soot and slate, turning the cobblestones slick and treacherous beneath Wren's boots. She pulled her father's charcoal wool overcoat tighter around her, the fabric heavy with damp, and quickened her pace. The appointment was for 10 o'clock. She had arrived at 9:30, giving herself time to steel herself against the sterile chill of the medical school. Time to remember that she was not here as a daughter seeking absolution, but as a creditor seeking leverage. The building rose from the street like a fortress of red brick, windowless save for the high, barred slits near the roofline. It smelled of wet stone and carbolic soap, a scent that clung to the back of the throat. Wren pushed through the heavy oak door and entered the vestibule, shaking the rain from her umbrella with a sharp, metallic click. A nurse in a starched white apron looked up from a desk cluttered with ledgers and inkwells. Her expression was unreadable, her posture rigid. "Miss Holloway," the nurse said, "it was not a question. Dr. Thorne is expecting you. The lift is to your left. He prefers the lower archives." Wren nodded. She did not trust her voice. If she spoke, she feared she might sound like the frightened girl who had sat in the train compartment an hour ago, staring at her own pale reflection and wondering if she had made a terrible mistake. Rather, she followed the nurse's gesture, stepping into the narrow cage of the lift. The mechanism groaned, a shuddering ascent of gears and counterweights that dropped her swiftly into the belly of the building. The air grew colder as she descended, the smell of ozone intensifying until it tasted metallic on her tongue. When the doors slid open, she was met with a corridor of white tile and gas lamps shielded by wire mesh. At the end of the hall, a door stood ajar. Dr. Aris Thorne was standing in the threshold, his hands clasped behind his back, his silhouette framed by the dim light of the room beyond. He was a tall man, balding, with eyes the color of weak tea. He looked at Wren not with the curiosity of a stranger, but with the weary recognition of a man who had been waiting for this moment for a very long time. "Miss Holloway," he said. His voice was clinical, detached, polite, but firm. "Please come in. Do not mind the mess. We are in the midst of a reorganization." The room was a windowless basement storage unit, humming with the low vibration of refrigeration units and smelling of ozone and old paper. Rows of metal shelving units rose to the ceiling, stacked with ledgers, bound reports, and crates of bones wrapped in burlap. In the center of the room, a heavy oak desk sat isolated, as if an island in a sea of bureaucracy. Thorne gestured to a chair opposite him. Wren sat, placing her umbrella carefully against the leg of the table. She kept her hands folded in her lap, her fingers stiff with cold. "You have the letter," Thorne said. "It was a statement." "I have the letter," Wren confirmed. "And I have the names. Gable, Mercer, 20 others I have managed to trace. But the ledger ends, doctor, it stops. And I need to know if that is where the record ends or if it is merely where my access ends." Thorne did not answer immediately. He turned to the shelves behind him, running a finger along the spines of a row of bound volumes. He selected one, a thick tome bound in cracked black leather, and brought it to the desk. He placed it down with a soft thud, then another, and another. By the time he turned back to face her, three heavy books lay between them, along with a sheaf of loose papers tied with string. "The Holloway Funeral Home operates on a principle of selective memory," Thorne said, settling into his own chair. "Your father understood this. He understood that grief makes people blind and that poverty makes them desperate. He offered a solution to both. He provided a service that the town believed was complete, while simultaneously providing a service to the university that the town could never imagine. It is a duality that requires strict accounting." Wren looked at the books. "Is this the accounting?" "It is the manifest," Thorne corrected. "The shipping records, from 1874 to the present. 47 years, Miss Holloway, 2 decades of commerce." He opened the top volume. The pages were yellowed, the ink faded but legible. Wren leaned forward. The entries were precise, devoid of sentiment. October 14, 1894. Mail, 61, cardiac failure. Source, Holloway and Son. Destination, Birmingham Medical School. Weight, 14 stone. Fee received from estate, £18. Payment to school, £4. Wren's breath caught. The numbers were familiar, but the context was alien. The fee from the estate was the standard rate, the rate she had charged Mrs. Gable. The payment to the school was a fraction of that. The difference was profit, but it was not just profit. It was theft. They had taken Arthur Gable's body, sold it for parts, and told his widow he had been cremated. She flipped to the next page. November 2, 1894. Female, 45, pneumonia, source, Halloway & Son, destination, Birmingham Medical School. Weight, 10 stone. Fee received, £15. Payment to school, £3. December 12, 1894. Male, 12, diphtheria, source, Halloway & Son, destination, Birmingham Medical School. Weight, 6 stone. Fee received, £10. Payment to school, £2. Wren's hand trembled. She closed the book abruptly. The sound echoed in the small room. "Children," she whispered. "Adolescents and adults alike," Thorne said. His tone remained neutral, as if discussing the weather. "The demand for cadavers is constant, Miss Halloway. Anatomy classes cannot pause for morality. And the poor do not have families who miss them. Or if they do, those families are often too impoverished to demand answers. Your father was a pragmatist. He saw a surplus of need and a surplus of supply, and he connected them." "He sold my neighbors," Wren said. The words felt heavy in her mouth like stones. "He facilitated the advancement of medicine," Thorne replied. "And he kept the lights on in this town. Do you think the funeral home survives on £18 per cremation? Do you think the roof does not leak, or the coal does not need buying, or Selah's does not need to eat? The illicit income subsidized the legitimate business. It allowed Halloway & Son to remain the premier provider in Oakhaven. Without it, the business would have collapsed in 1882. Wren stared at him. "You're saying it was necessary." "I am saying it was effective," Thorne corrected, "and it was sustainable, until it was." He tapped the stack of papers tied with string. "These are the recent records, the last 5 years, since your father's health declined and Selah's took over the daily management. The volume has decreased, but the practice continues. Thomas Mercer, Eleanor Vance, James Cole, all accounted for, all paid for, all delivered." Wren picked up the sheaf of papers. Her fingers brushed the rough texture of the paper. She read the names: Mercer, Vance, Cole, three names she had processed in the last 6 months. Three urns she had handed to grieving families, filled with ash from the timber mill, pretending they contained their loved ones. "How many?" she asked. "In total, over the 20 years." Thorne leaned back, interlacing his fingers. He looked at her with those pale, tea-colored eyes, and for the first time, Wren saw something other than detachment in his gaze. It was pity, or perhaps it was relief. 47, he said. 47 bodies, sold, over 20 years. That is the total, Miss Halloway. 47 souls traded for the advancement of science and the survival of a business. The question now is not what happened. The question is what you will do with the knowledge of what happened. Wren looked down at the manifest. The numbers swam before her eyes. 47, it was not a handful. It was not a few exceptions. It was a systematic, calculated enterprise. It was a machine, and her father had built it, and Selah's had kept it running. And she was standing in the wreckage, holding the blueprint. "Why give this to me?" she asked. "Why not burn it? Why not keep it hidden as your father did?" Thorne sighed. It was a long, weary sound, like air escaping a punctured lung. "Because I am tired, Miss Halloway. I have spent 20 years looking at these books. I have spent 20 years watching men and women dissect the bodies of the forgotten, knowing exactly where they came from. I have told myself it was for science. I have told myself it was necessary. But lately, when I look at these names, I do not see students learning anatomy. I see mothers. I see fathers. I see children. And I cannot bear it anymore. I hoped that your father would see the rot." But he did not. He doubled down. He believed he could outrun his conscience. He was wrong. He reached into his pocket and produced a small brass key. He placed it on the desk beside the manifest. "This opens the secondary archive," he said. "There are photographs, medical records, letters from the families of the donors, if any survived, everything you need to prove it, everything you need to destroy them." "Then the cycle continues," Thorne said. "Selah's will keep selling, the town will keep paying, the dead will keep disappearing. You will take over this business, and with it, all its accounts." "And if I do nothing?" she asked. Thorne's gaze sharpened. "The wheel turns again," he murmured. "Selah's will sell, the town will pay, and the dead will vanish. You inherit their deceit, Ren Holloway. Is that the name you wish to bear? She did not answer. She could not. The weight of the question pressed against her chest, squeezing the air from her lungs. She thought of Maeve Collins and the urn that was too light. She thought of Arthur Gable and the widow who waited for a letter that would never come. She thought of her father, sitting at this very desk, calculating the difference between 18 pounds and 4 pounds, deciding that the math was worth the moral cost. She picked up the key. It was cold in her hand. "I need to go," she said. Thorne nodded. He did not try to stop her. He simply watched as she stood, gathering the manifest and the key into her bag. He turned back to the shelves, his shoulders slumped, as if the burden of the truth had been lifted from him, and he was too exhausted to care where it landed. Ren walked out of the room, down the corridor of white tile, and into the lift. The mechanism groaned, lifting her back toward the surface, toward the rain and the gray light of Birmingham. She stood in the narrow cage, her hand clutching the strap of her bag, feeling the hard edge of the manifest pressing against her side. She had the evidence, she had the proof, she had the legal and factual basis for exposure. There was no doubt left, no ambiguity, no room for interpretation. The lift shuddered to a halt at the ground floor. The doors opened. The nurse at the desk looked up, her expression unchanged. "Leaving so soon, Miss Holloway?" "Yes," Ren said. Her voice was steady, precise, guarded. "I have what I came for." She stepped out into the rain. The curtain of gray swallowed her whole. She did not open her umbrella. She let the water soak through her hair, her coat, her skin. She walked toward the station, the manifest heavy in her bag, the key heavy in her pocket, and the weight of 47 names heavy in her heart. The train to Oak Haven did not leave for another hour. Ren found a bench in the waiting room, far from the other passengers, and sat down. She placed the manifest on her lap and opened it to the first page. She read the name, Arthur Gable. She read the date, October 14th. She read the fee, 18 pounds. She closed the book. She closed her eyes, and she waited for the train to come, carrying her back to the house, to the ledger, to the silence.